Welcome to the Open House podcast site. Available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Chips, Knight Rider, Hardcastle and McCormick, The A-Team. If you get me started on 80s TV shows that I loved as a kid, you are never going to shut me up. And I even confess to watching Mork and Mindy. I reckon you probably did too. Well, I've got two individuals on the phone now who starred in many of those shows. And if this is a where are they now type interview, you're going to find their journey getting to where they are now, both heartbreaking but also full of hope. Willie Ames was known to millions as the girl-crazy, trouble-prone teenager Tommy Bradford in that great 80s TV show, Eight Is Enough. And he was also starred as Buddy, the co-star opposite Scott Baio in Charles in Charge. He later married Malo Upton, and she had starred in shows like Santa Barbara, Hardcastle and McCormick, The A-Team, the list goes on. Both of you, welcome to Open House.
Thank you for having us.
It's good to have you here.
I confess, I watched Mork and Mindy as well.
Oh, do you? Did you watch The Waltons?
I actually was on The Waltons.
Oh, were you?
I was on The Waltons. I go all the way back to Gunsmoke. Shows like The Courtship of Eddie's Father and Adam 12. But The Waltons was one of the shows that I did regularly before Eight Is Enough.
There you go. I didn't even realize that. Well, let's go back to those early years then. Tell me about, most people will know about your time on Eight Is Enough. That's probably the most you'll be known of, as well as Charles in Charge. But let's go back to Eight Is Enough. What are your memories of being on the set of that?
Well, being on Eight Is Enough for me was a little bit different, I think, than it was for any of the other cast members, because Eight Is Enough was already my seventh network series. And I had learned pretty quickly when I was very young, 8 and 9 years old, that the entertainment business is a very transitory business. You are quick friends and good friends, and then suddenly one day, somebody shuts it off and nobody sees each other again. So when I hit Eight Is Enough, I was already, well-seasoned, had done lots and lots of movies and television and series. And so I looked at it as a job. By that time I was just 15 and I was already pretty jaded, thinking, television is nothing but filler for commercials.
Well, you've been in so many things, and as you've mentioned there, I happened to bring one up, The Waltons, and you've happened to have starred in it. What, for you, though, what was your peak Hollywood moment? When did you realize I have made it?
Sharon, I have to tell you, I never have thought I have made it at any time. I would say that probably the most popular show had to have been Eight Is Enough, and then after that, Charles in Charge, because Eight Is Enough was the number one show in the United States at the time. And, we only had a few networks, so we had a 50 share. So that meant 50% of the televisions in America were tuned to that show. Mm-hmm. But never had I ever, or have I ever, felt as though I had made it, that I had arrived. I don't see myself that way. Yeah. I don't see what I do. When I was touring with my band, I could walk out in front of 20,000 screaming girls and come off the stage completely depressed, just thinking, these people don't know me. They're in love with the show. They're not in love with me.
Let's explore that a little bit further. What was going on off screen for you during that peak time of Eight Is Enough? What were the fans not aware of?
Well, I think a large section of the fan base had no idea that, there were so many things going on behind the set with me. And that's one of the reasons that we wrote the book, especially when you look at Lindsay Lohan and Britney Spears and Paris and all of these people that are having so many troubles in their lives. Closer to your home with Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
I was always a very sensitive person. I never felt as though I was really that I really fit in anywhere. I never felt as though I fit in with my family. I wanted to be accepted very badly, and quite honestly, never wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be a marine biologist.
Really?
And the only reason I did anything with acting was because it was a way for me to try to set myself apart from my brothers and sisters. And when you have that kind of a personality that is both very extreme, kind of addictive, 1,000% in any direction, pick one, and also very sensitive, I think you end up with people that are creative and addictive at the same time. And I had started drinking when I was very young. I started smoking pot when I was 13 or 14 in school with my friends, and as I began to tour more with my bands and I began to do more in the television industry, the drugs and alcohol and kind of living the faster lifestyle just kicked in. And then add to that the normal rebelliousness of wanting to break away from your family and being completely controlled all the time by managers and agents and your parents and the set and the studio. And you're really just kind of tightening up the rubber band and getting ready to let it loose. And that's what I did.
Yeah. And of course, we're still talking about your teenage years, let alone the years that would follow after that. And you have written the story in a book called Grace is Enough, and it's quite a riveting read. In fact, your story includes a suicide attempt at the age of 3. What on earth was going on for you at that age to even contemplate that?
It's funny that, you know, people think about me trying to hang myself at 3 as suicide attempts. I really can't say that it was an honest suicide attempt, because at that age, you know, I don't think I had the full big picture of what a suicide attempt would be. I just knew that I was very lonely, that I didn't know if anybody really cared if anything happened to me. And I wondered what it would be like to be dead, and I was going to find out. So that's, you know, it wasn't really a rational decision to try and kill myself or you know, any kind of a specific decision. It was really a curiosity that was born out of emotion. Later on, as I began to run away from home at 5, you know, I began to understand that what I really wanted was somebody to come after me. Mm. I really wanted to feel as though, you know, the family would come after me and care. And it took a long time to understand what that meant.
Yeah. Just describe the family life then. Why were you so lonely?
Well, you know, I grew up in a very strict environment where one had to achieve. It was also very, I think, austere might be the word. Just, you know, Dad had his rules, and one of them was you never left your toys in the driveway. And if you did, he wouldn't get out and move them and restrict you from them or something like that. He'd just drive over them. Mm. You know, if you left your bicycle in the driveway, didn't matter. Up and over, low gear, here you go, and your bike would be ruined. Yeah. I think angry for a good part of the time. It was a very austere situation.
Yeah. This is Open House right across Australia. Willie and Malo Ames are with us with their story of Hollywood success, disaster, redemption. We're going to get to that soon. We're going to podcast this via the openhouse.net.au as well. Malo, let's turn to you, because at the height of Willie's success, so to speak, you're actually a teenage runaway living on the streets. Now, what's happened at this point in time to lead you to that kind of life?
Well, I grew up in a home that my mother is schizophrenic. She was involved in an occult, and my father had left the house before I was even a year old, so she had brought men into the home that were considered to be, one was considered to be an apostle of this religious group, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of physical violence, a lot of sexual violence, and abuse starting when I was 11 until I was 15, and I finally ran away right before my 16th birthday, and figured that the streets of Hollywood made more sense. It was black and white and dangerous, but black and white and not as twisted and sick as what was going on at my mother's house. So while Willie was at the height of his fame, I was on the streets, and the hotel that has since been torn down that was next to the Grauman's Chinese Theater, where a lot of runaways and street people crashed and sought shelter out of, like I said, right next door to Grauman's Chinese Theater. And I would be literally yards away while Willie was getting out of a limousine to go see a movie premiere. We didn't know each other. So
wow.
Pretty interesting.
Destiny.
Two completely different worlds and right next to each other for so many years until we finally met on a show that I was doing for a cable network called Rocky Road, and Willie guest starred on it, and that's how we met.
Did your mother, Malo, know of the abuse that you were suffering from the hands of her partners?
She knew. She would walk in on it, but she never acknowledged it. She would walk in and say, dinner is going to be ready in 35 minutes. It was like she was not going to acknowledge it or act like she saw it. It was one of the biggest frustrations in my life, even as an adult after I left the house, was that there was no acknowledgement whatsoever that it happened, even though we were all standing in the same room when it was going on.
Yeah. And so this religious group that she was a part of, how did that actually affect her and then inadvertently affect you? I mean, what kind of things would go on as a result of her involvement in that group?
Well, she was unstable to begin with. Of course, many years later, long after I was an adult, she was diagnosed with severe paranoid schizophrenia. Some of it, I think, as a consequence of living so many years in a kind of different world. It was a very tight-knit group of people. They followed one man, and they all believed that they had special powers to transport themselves in and out of paintings and do certain things. There was lots of seances and tarot cards, and my mother believed that she could make things happen with her mind, that she would be able to lay down on the couch and imagine one thing or another, and that it would come to pass, which was pretty ridiculous because we were constantly being evicted. So I never really understood as a child, if you could lay down on the couch and think something up and have it happen, why are we always so poor?
Yeah, of course. No wonder you hit the streets, and then you later get involved in drugs, and I can imagine that probably followed simply by living on the streets. At what stage, though, then do you then have this dream of actually becoming an actress? And then how did you make the transition from streets to actress?
You know, I know it sounds really like, what? How did that happen? Yeah. Actually, one of the things that my mother had was this, she really felt like somehow she was special and different, you know, like she was this special apostle, and her kids were special and different, and that I was going to be some superstar on television and hook up with, you know, some other superstar. So she, at a very early age, started sending me, when she could afford it, to dance classes and little kind of acting theater groups and things like that. But I was always falling out because we had to move or she ran out of money or whatever. So even when I was little, she would tell me, this is what you're going to do.
Okay.
And this has to be done for the good of the group, because it'll be a public way to get people's attention, and it'll be through you. And it was all very twisted and connected to this group. And later, after I had run away from home, I was on the streets and I heard about a dance scholarship audition. And it was for underprivileged kids. If you got it, then you had this dance, you take six classes a day, which to me was like, oh, that would be some place to be, you know, one place to be, a roof over your head. So I went and stuck a number on my chest and auditioned, and I got the scholarship along with some other kids, and somebody brought an agent to one of the classes to kind of view, and the agent approached me afterwards and just said, you know, I really believe you can do something. Let me send you out on a couple of auditions, and off we went.
Well, this is Open House. We're talking to Willie and Malo Ames, who have both had their share of success in 80s TV programs, Hardcastle and McCormick, the A-Team, and Willie Ames, best known for Eight Is Enough, and Charles in Charge. So, Willie, as far as the storyline is concerned now, you have already had a marriage fall apart by this time, and while you and Malo haven't met yet, her star is beginning to rise, and yours is actually beginning to fall a bit at this time. When did things really begin to crumble for you personally?
They really kind of started right at the end of Eight Is Enough, about 1979, going on 80. And it is odd, you know. I'd be eating out of the White House, and Malo would be eating out of trash cans. And I look at it today, and I still can't believe that we did meet. But right at the end of 1979, I really started to spend a lot of time with my band and started doing a lot of cocaine and wasn't speaking to any of my family. And I thought, well, I'll start my own family. So I got married. And that's really when things started to fall apart, because I was getting married for all the wrong reasons. I was just trying to reach out for something again that would, that could stabilize me, something that could make sense to me. And again, to feel as though I really mattered, even though I had all of the success. I had had a son by the time I was 20. I had been doing Zapped with Scott Baio, the movie, and had done another movie with Phoebe Cates in Israel called Paradise. When I finally hit about 23, 24, I found myself down in the jungle in Venezuela doing a movie down there and just doing a ton of cocaine. I mean, they were just making it right down the road, and it was very inexpensive and, you know, and high quality. And I was just out of control. I mean, just going through tons of coke and drinking around the clock and trying to shoot this movie. And at the same time, I was reading the book Wired, which was the John Belushi story, and not only recognized, you know, people in it, but recognized myself in it.
Right.
And I knew that I had to make a change. And by that time, I had gone from living, you know, in a 3,000-square-foot home on the beach with a pool and jacuzzi in the front yard to literally just working on the commercial dive boats for $30 a day and cleaning toilets. Mm. And about that time that I was working on the boats and really had nothing left, lost my house, my Porsche, literally everything, was about the time that a friend asked me to do a guest starring part on this cable show. And in those days, if you did cable, you had just reached the very bottom. The dive boats were better than cable.
Okay.
and I ended up doing the show, and that's where I met Mano. You know, and then her co-star actually started, you know, saying, ask her out, ask her out. I finally said, okay, I'll ask her to lunch. So I went up and I asked Mano, I said, would you like to have lunch with me? And she looked at me and she went, yeah, right, if you take me and the entire cast and crew.
Not playing hard to get or anything, Mano, are you?
It's like 40 people.
I thought that would make him go away. I thought he would think I was conceited and he would leave.
And I just kind of laughed and said, okay. So I called my favorite Thai restaurant and set it up. And the next day we went to lunch and I sat across the table from her with all the rest of the people and said, your move. And she wouldn't even look at me. She was so mad she wouldn't even look at me. And I just, you know, I was just in that kind of a mood where I was like, all right, you know, go ahead. Let's see what happens. So, but we started to talk, you know, I could really tell that even though there was a lot of surface stuff going on, like drugs and the alcohol and stuff, there was a very incredible person inside, somebody that I just was really drawn to and needed to get to know.
Yeah.
And, you know, besides that, she had a great pushy.
He really has a way with words and with women, doesn't he, Mano?
I know.
So let's jump a bit then, because you two do actually get married, and I know I'm jumping a little while here in time. We've introduced the characters, we've set the scene, and we've progressed to the tragedy, and we're starting to see a little bit of the redemption. Now I want to know the real redemptive part. How did God walk into your lives? Mano, take the story away. At what stage did that happen?
You know, when I look back on my life, I can see that God was there beside me the whole way. I just didn't see him. I just didn't. I think I was so anti-religion because of my mom, you know, and I didn't understand that. It wasn't about religion, you know. It was just simply about God loving me. And when I really kind of went looking for him, was when Willie he started taking me to like AA meetings and stuff, and I got sober, and I was in the car and I heard this man on the radio, and he was talking, and he sounded like a great AA speaker. He was funny and he seemed to really kind of understand life and being a human being and how kind of dorky we all are, and I was laughing, and I told Willie about him. And then about a week later we were in the car again, and I heard that same guy, and I said, hey, this is that man I was telling you about. And it turned out after we listened to the show that it was a Christian radio station, which appalled us both, and it was a pastor on the radio, which appalled us even more. And we thought, well, we should go and see him, you know, on some Sunday morning. I mean, it'd be funny. And then our very next thought was, yeah, we're going to become what? Christians? Are you kidding me? That's a laugh. But we did. We went to this church, and I remember both of us were smoking cigarettes, and I had, you know, outfit on that just really didn't fit in with all the kind of Bobs and Bettys and Janes, and, you know, the ladies all had little barrettes and nylon stockings. And I thought, oh, geez, I'm not going to do well here. And but we went in, and there was five or six people up on stage, and they were each individually giving their stories, just talking about where they have been, sort of like we are today. And we saw something in them. Like Willie says, you know, he didn't realize that hope was what he needed until he saw it presented to him, that these people's their lives weren't all fixed. It's not like, you know, you become a Christian and everything gets all wrapped up in a tidy bow. We all still have problems, but they had something, hope. They had faith that it was going to get better. And we didn't have that. I was just simply jaded, trying to get through each day without falling apart into a heap of tears. These people were able to laugh at their situation, and they were able to believe in a future. And that is really the beginning. Thought, I want to get to know this God.
That's a beautiful story. Did you continue on with that particular church for many years, or did you move? Or at what point did you finally say, right, this Jesus that I've heard about, I'm giving in, I'm committing my life to him?
You know, I was in counseling because my poor husband was like, I'm so in over my head with you, you got to get some counseling. And I counseled with a pastor at this church. And that pastor, for whatever reason, and I think, you know, people had tried to talk to me about Jesus Christ before, and I kind of laughed at him and whatever, but for whatever reason, my heart at that moment in time, the way this man presented it to me, it just felt true. And he talked to me about how God sees me and how much Jesus loves me, and that all those questions that I had, like, well, if he does, you know, how could he allow such horrendous things to happen to just, you know, a little girl, a child, 11 years old? So awesome, because he said, I don't have those answers. I just know that when he looks at you, he's astounded at how beautiful you are and how much he loves you and how you've come through, and he's anxious for you to know him. And it just felt right. It felt like the father that I wanted, the way that this man presented Jesus Christ to me. It felt like the daddy I didn't have. It felt like the love that I needed, that Willie had said, you know, I can't fix you. You need something bigger than me. And then, you know, a few months later, here it was presented to me. And I just submitted everything in that man's office to God. It was really neat, because when we were done praying, I lifted my head. Willie was there, and the three of us lifted our heads, and this pastor said, you know, you are brand new. You're like a virgin. What was stolen from you has been restored. God's going to restore everything that was taken away from you. And I really clung to that, and it has been true. It has been proven to be true over these past 22 years.
Yeah.
I wasn't supposed to have kids because of everything that happened to me, and I was blessed with it, with a daughter and a home and love in my life, and it's just amazing. I stand in awe that I'm even alive.
Yeah, he really has restored what the locusts have taken, as the famous quote in the Old Testament says. Willie, what about you? What was the turning point for you? When did you finally give in to God?
I gave in a little bit earlier. That day that we first walked into the church is really when it hit me, because I, you know, going through the 12-step programs, which are terrific, they kept saying, there was one thing I was never brought up with, and that was any kind of religion. And they kept saying, you know, God as you understand him, God as you understand him. And I'd say, I don't have any understanding of God. What is it? And they'd say, well, just pick all of the things that you think would make a good God and create your own.
Okay.
And I'd sit there and go, if I'm an alcoholic and an addict, and basically my best thinking turned me into this, why on earth would I follow a God of my own creation? I mean, I'm just following an alcoholic addict God. And as I went along, you know, I've known all of the things that I've done in my life. I knew all the just skanky, stupid things that you do when you're, you know, living your life that way. And when I saw those people standing up there, you know, I'd been through divorce, I'd been through all kinds of stuff, and I realized that they did have hope, not for, you know, more money or a better house or that your bills will be paid, but as a creature, there was hope for me to be better inside than I knew I was. That's what really did it for me. I remember just sitting there thinking, that's it. I need hope for what I could be, and a hope that's not going to disappear on me next week. That was really when I said, okay. You know, it's not been a pretty transition. You know, sometimes we do some things that are still not a very good look, but, you know, we always have that hope. We can always start over again, and it's really such a message in our book about hope and about grace. And, you know, when you look at grace and you try to think about what that is, it's a completely non-judgmental acceptance of who you are, the way you are, with nothing to change. It's difficult sometimes to explain to people that, you know, it's not about a bunch of rules and regulations. It's about one person accepting complete and total acceptance from God. That's it. You know, that whole concept was just mind-blowing once I got it down.
Well, it's an amazing story. We have scratched only the surface of it because, of course, your lives have continued to go on from that point on. Many parents listening to us will know of your work. Willie is a Bible Man, the series that really enthralled kids for so many years, and you are continuing to do many TV projects together. I guess that's what the book is for, Grace is Enough, where people can actually get a little bit more of a story of where you have come from that point on. Really has been great having you on Open House, though. Thanks for both opening up and sharing your story on it.
Thank you so much for having us. I hope we get to do it in person one day.
Well, we hope so too. Willie and Malo Ames there, and the book is called Grace is Enough. It's through Broadman and Holman Publishers, and we'll podcast this via the openhouse.net.au if you'd like to take a second listen.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.